It's Let's Talk Legal here on the Talk Station FM 107.1. Joining us this afternoon, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as always, I'd like to remind you at the beginning of the program and throughout, when you're looking for good legal direction and assistance, and I can tell you protection in the future, go to Harvell and Collins. By the way, go to their website, harvellandcollins.com, or you can give them a call, 252-726-9050. And with that introduction, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood.
So the topic today, what will we be talking about?
Wes, I'll let you introduce our topic.
Right. So, Lockwood, over the past couple of weeks, of course, we talked about real estate holdings. We talked about the different ways that individuals or groups, co-owners, can own real property. We talked about tenants by entirety and tenants in common, and those programs, you can link to those on our website. And that kind of led us to last week when we were talking about real property holdings in corporate entities. We talked about corporations, closely held corporations, S-corporations, which is a tax election, and we talked about limited liability companies and those real estate holdings. And that leads us to a little bit more discussion regarding these entities, mm-hmm. regarding corporations, regarding limited liability companies. And the primary focus of our conversation today, I think, is going to be really kind of how do you get out of the corporation, of the LLC? What if you have a co-owner of your business who has basically withdrawn mm-hmm. and is not really contributing anymore?
Right.
What if you have a death of a co-owner? What if you have a co-owner who had to file bankruptcy individually and his or her shares are being dragged into the bankruptcy court, which affects the corporation? So the ins and outs of that, the importance of having what we refer to as a shareholders agreement or buy-sell agreement, and how that is very important in the event that you are a co-owner of a corporation with someone. And we're primarily talking about what we refer to as closely held corporations.
Okay.
Something that's maybe two owners or four owners or something that's going to be a little bit more prevalent here in North Carolina. We're not talking about Coca-Cola.
Right, right. Right.
You know, we're talking about our typical somewhat mom and pop or co-owners, co-partners type corporation or LLC.
All right, I have one quick question, and I'm going to throw a kind of a wrench into the conversation here very quickly, but, you know, we talk about corporations. I do know, and I really don't understand the difference between, and I want to just touch on this, a C-corp versus an S-corp. And I think that's really more of a tax issue, but it may also be a legal issue that I'm not privy to. And is there any kind of benefit to one corporation over another?
Both an S-corp and a C-corp are corporations.
Right.
And there really is no difference in their structure or their requirements or the way in which they are organized, if you will,
okay.
other than the fact that an S-corporation has a tax election that it be taxed as an S corporation. I'm going to explain that in a minute. But the bottom line is that there really is no difference
okay.
between the two, other than the way, which is a big distinction, other than the way in which they count,
okay.
other than the way in which they are taxed. And the distinct difference is that in an S corporation, all of the profits and losses of the corporation passed down to the shareholders and are then captured on the shareholders' individual returns. So there is no corporate tax. There is no tax, profit and or loss, in terms of accounting-wise, at the corporate level. It's all accounted for at the shareholder level, whereas a C corporation is going to operate more like its own distinct entity, tax-wise. It's going to have its profits and losses and pay corporate tax or have corporate deductions, and is going to walk and talk as its own taxable entity.
Okay.
A C-corp is not really its own taxable entity. The tax consequences are captured at the shareholder level.
Okay.
The S-corp.
And so that's the primary difference between the two.
The S-corp is the flow through.
Which is really a taxing difference.
Okay. And as you pointed out just a moment ago, Wes, and you mentioned C-corp, Cecil, but you meant S-corp in the sense that the money flows directly to the, or the liabilities, I should say, both profits and...
It's the S-corp that the profits and losses pass to the individual shareholders. It's the C-corp that acts as its own taxable entity.
Okay.
Right,
I apologize for that interruption, but as you're talking about corporations, I know that some people are privy to the fact that there are such things as C-corps. But in essence, what we're talking about applies to all of those situations.
Right. So, you know, referring to the situation where, you know, you're in this business, you have a co-owner, and then let's say that the co-owner dies.
Right.
Okay. You have a valuable business. Okay, and he owns half of the stock. All right, so what then happens? Well, if you don't have a shareholders agreement that determines what happens, then where do we find ourselves?
Right.
We find ourselves where the stock then passes under the estate plan, presumably the will of the person who died. Okay, so now the surviving owner has a new
partner,
co-owner.
Right.
All right. Is this co-owner a spouse that doesn't know anything about the business? Is this co-owner children? Who is this new co-owner?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All right. So in most cases in that situation, the surviving partner or surviving owner of the business is not going to want to just carry on business with someone who doesn't know anything about the business,
mm-hmm.
the surviving spouse, the children, so on and so forth, they're going to want to do what?
Either
purchase the shares.
Or sell the shares outright, total. Yeah.
Could sell the company completely, but do we really want to force ourselves into that
mm-hmm.
by not planning? So we may want to buy those shares. Okay. So then we're dealing with an estate. Okay. Because the co-owner died, his estate holds the shares, they're passing through the estate administration process to the children, to the spouse, whomever it may be. And then we get into an issue of how do we value the shares?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are many ways to value, to mechanisms to use to value a corporation, to value shares. So if we have a shareholders agreement that indicates that upon a death, upon a bankruptcy, upon a divorce filing, upon, you know, certain triggering events, then this is how we, number one, value the shares.
Mm-hmm.
We determine how that happens. In many cases, we have every 18 months the opportunity for the co-owners to enter an agreement as to what the value of the business is. So we don't get into an argument with regard to the value.
Uh-huh.
See, if we don't have that shareholders agreement, we are basically inviting a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
We're inviting a battle of the experts. My expert business valuation, my business valuation expert against yours. And then in a court of law, potentially, that is where the value is determined and the purchase price is determined. And moreover, we're putting the surviving owner of the business in quite a disadvantage because there's no compulsion whatsoever
mm-hmm.
for the surviving spouse, the surviving kids to sell. They don't have to, unless you have the buy-sell agreement that requires the sale. So what does that do? That puts the surviving spouse, surviving children in the driver's seat, and the co-owner of the business in a position where he basically has to meet their price.
Right.
A little complicated there, but that's, you know, a very broad explanation as to, in a death scenario, why these buy-sell agreements or shareholder agreements are very important. And if you don't have these put in place, then and you have an event such as a death, you know, like I said, a bankruptcy, a divorce, you know, some of the, so a withdrawing member who is not contributing, then in many cases you find yourself as a co-owner of the business with your hands tied.
Right. You know, we're talking. That was Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and I've got a question before we take this quick break. And of course, we're talking about the issue of corporations and buy-sell agreements, as we just heard a moment ago. Wes, you said every 18 months you do a basically a revaluation. Is there some magic to that, or was that just a random number to 18?
It's not law. It's not statutory. It's not in any case. So there's no magic to that. It's not in the North Carolina Business Corporations Act or anything like that. It's just what I probably see more often than not in a typical buy-sell agreement.
Okay.
Normally have an option A and option B.
Mm-hmm.
Option A is if we have decided that the value of the business is a certain number and we have put that in writing through a resolution for the corporation within 18 months of the event, which would be like 18 months of the death,
right,
then that is the value.
Okay.
If we have failed to do that, which, by the way, happens all the time, folks, you know, put their book on the shelf and don't think about it.
Right.
And, you know, the person passes, we're dealing with the estate, and we see there's that option A. Well, the last time they considered the value was back in 1998 when
right.
the corporation was started.
Right.
Well, that's no good. So then we have to go to option B, which is, okay, now let's look at the procedure for valuing this business. Okay, but thank goodness we have the shareholders agreement. Because
right.
in many cases, there's not a shareholders agreement, and that really opens everything up to a lot of interpretation, opinion, argument, which we could have otherwise avoided with a relatively simple legal document signed on the front end.
All right, that's Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. You're listening to Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And remind you, the phone number for get more information, 252-726-9050, or go online to Harvell and Collins, spell out the word and, harvellandcollins.com. I want to come back to this topic on the shareholders agreements with two quick questions. And Cecil, of course, you touched on this last week, and the fact is that you've got to do corporate minutes on a regular basis, and I'm wondering, is this part of the procedure? But also, one other experience, and you have a lot of instances where you have two friends who purchase a piece of real estate or maybe a business, and you know, it muddles along, and then all of a sudden, it accelerates, and the values go up, sometimes astronomically. A case in point would probably be real estate here in along the coastal region of the state, which is becoming very popular. So suddenly, you know, unbeknownst, but a lot of the owners are just sort of going along. They have their own activities. They're busy, et cetera. And one day they discover, gosh, that $100,000 property that we purchased is now worth 10 times or maybe even 20 times that value. Does that happen, and is that part of the conversation that you have, for example, when you establish these programs for corporate minutes?
Well, Lockwood, it does, and that's, of course, why Wes is alluding to this, you know, as he said, 18 months, but it can be 12 months. We find, you know, a yearly kind of check-in, if you will, a yearly meeting of the mind. Is valuable, but yes, 18 months, a year and a half is just fine as well. So there certainly needs to be a meeting of the minds you know, once a year to every year and a half, and it would be at that time that this appraisal information would be updated and looked at and agreed to. Now, some of the other details relative to these shareholder agreements are, you know, what if one of the partners or shareholders becomes disabled?
Mm-hmm.
What if they're in an accident, God forbid? Of course, there's always the possibility of death, that someone were to be in an accident or even with natural or disease processes no longer living, you know. And then, of course, then there can be just withdrawal. In other words, just getting out of the business corporation, the partner, shareholder, just due to family circumstances, whatever, due to any kind of variation, they feel that they no longer need to be involved in the corporation. So you have death, you have disability, you have withdrawal. And all of these provisions would be included in the shareholder agreement. And, of course, the consequences of any of that, death, withdrawal, or disability. Sometimes with regard to death, there can be a life insurance policy purchased in the mix so as to allow there to be the liquidity for the surviving partner to be able to buy out the family of the deceased partner. That is a fairly common ingredient in this type of planning that we do. You're right, Lockwood, that sometimes people just start these corporations with a hope and a prayer, and that's about all there is to it.
Right.
And then a year, two, 3 years later, they're moving and grooving and doing quite well, and that's wonderful. But with that success, we remind our listeners, Wes and I want to remind our listeners here on the radio program, that with that success comes, you know, if you will, the obligation, the duty to get one's affairs in order.
Right.
You have a viable, successful corporate entity. It's time to seek out some good legal advice. Get some consultation with your lawyer. Sometimes the accountants are also involved, and begin to put together some of these documents that any corporation would need, you know, so that these contingencies can be dealt with if the corporation is confronted with any of those contingencies. Mm-hmm. Again, just voluntary withdrawal, a death, a disability, any of those things can affect, you know, the ongoing business.
One of the things that I always like to point out or question here is the issue of liability. And Wes, you brought up the topic a few moments ago, well, earlier in the program, about the issue of bankruptcy. How is that handled in these circumstances? Because, you know, we in a case of a limited liability corporation or S-Corp, you know, three individuals, one of them has a personal liability issue. How is that handled?
So in the event that an individual shareholder is in a bankruptcy, is required or chooses to file bankruptcy, because, you know, obviously if they're having to file bankruptcy, there's a particular financial problem in their own life that they're having to deal with. Well, the point there with regard to the bankruptcy and the interplay between the bankruptcy and the corporation that needs to be made is we want to make sure that our governing documents, including, and most notably, this shareholders agreement, allows for the corporation to not be basically dragged into that bankruptcy proceeding.
That right there is probably, I mean, no one knows what's going to happen, and I'm using bankruptcy, but it could be a liability case where suddenly you're being sued for some event. Okay. Keep talking, because this,
right,
that really is sort of a kind of a bell ringer here.
A couple layers there. Bankruptcy first, liability of an individual shareholder second. So I'll talk about bankruptcy first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the event we have an individual owner who is in a bankruptcy, then if the corporate shares are assets that have to be brought into this bankruptcy to deal with the bankruptcy court, then the corporation itself is essentially going to be a necessary party or an interested party in the outcome of the bankruptcy proceeding. Mm-hmm. If our shares are intertwined into this federal court bankruptcy proceeding, then what does this corporation really need to do? Well, they probably need to hire an attorney to deal with the bankruptcy. That costs money. That they need to, you know, potentially attend hearings relative to the bankruptcy. They need to be involved in the filings, and the attorney would need to raise any kind of objections, so on and so forth, and protect the rights of the corporation. Well, would we rather have the corporation have to go through that expense, that headache, that situation for months and months, if not years, because of one of our co-owners had to go into a bankruptcy, or would we simply rather have a shareholders agreement that indicates that bankruptcy by a shareholder is a triggering event that then allows us to then discharge that co-owner from the business? Now, there would be a provision as to how we would have to compensate that co-owner, that shareholder. But then that compensation is paid into the bankruptcy court, and we get the shares back.
Right.
Okay, so everyone's basically, the remaining shareholders' interest increases, but then we're out of the bankruptcy.
In essence, it's a buy-sell trigger.
That's right.
Okay.
And the
All
bankruptcy
right.
court would recognize that.
Okay.
Would allow that, would not think it was some type of mechanism to avoid liability.
All right, and that goes, of course, to the issue of setting values in advance.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. This is one of those type things that, you know, everything is fine until it's not.
Right.
And then when it's not, you're going to have to look back at your documents. It's like everything else. I mean, we talk about, okay, everything's great when you're having a house built for you, until it's not.
Right.
Until the walls start falling down, until the contractor runs away with your money.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are we doing? Well, we're looking at the contract that was entered. We're looking at the document to see what you can recover. We're looking at the rights to for material breach, you know, what your rights are, what you can collect. Can you get your attorney's fees back? Can you get interest back?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so on and so forth. We're getting back to the paper. So in this corporate context, if there is no paper, if there is no shareholders agreement, well, in that scenario that I just laid out for you, we've got a corporation that's going to have to ride through this bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that normally is something that you want to avoid.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
So having your documentation in place on the front end that's pretty broad, that deals with lots of different triggering events, death, bankruptcy, divorce, disability, a withdrawing member. There has to be some definition there, but a withdrawing member, these type of triggering events, then this is what we do. Well, it really is a two-way street. It protects the shareholder that's going through that event, okay, and it protects the corporation or the LLC so it can continue to do business,
right,
as opposed to being dragged down and bogged down with the whatever the particular situation is that the shareholder's going through.
We're talking with Wes Collins, of course, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And by the way, that number, 252-726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. All right. Wes, I brought up the issue of bankruptcy. Now my question is liability. For example, one of the parties is sued.
Right. Well, sometimes you include in these documents provisions regarding if they are a defendant in a civil action. I mean, I've already identified one, which is divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, the reason that that is one you normally include is because you're normally in a divorce going to be dealing with an equitable distribution situation. And so it's very likely that the corporate shares could be a marital asset. So they're under the jurisdiction of the district court wherever the divorce is pending, so that we're pretty much very similar to the bankruptcy situation in a situation where the corporation itself is subject to what happens relative to the equitable distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're in a situation where the corporation most likely needs an attorney in this divorce case.
Right.
I mean, I've served as corporate counsel for corporations on many occasions when husband and wife are going through a divorce,
mm-hmm.
because the corporation ends up being somewhat on the chopping block.
Right.
You know, so that, again, we have our shareholders agreement. We're able to pay out. We put the money into the pot, and that's the asset they deal with based on the agreement or the 18-month, the valuation, if there had been one, from the date of divorce or separation. Liability-wise, yes, you can have situations where in the event you have a defendant or a shareholder who is a defendant and a lawsuit is being sued, that potentially that could be a triggering event. Also, you know, we sometimes get into the situation where the corporate shares are subject to a judgment.
Right.
I don't want to be overly technical here in our last couple minutes, but let's say you have a shareholder who's been sued and there's a judgment against them,
mm-hmm.
and then the judgment holder, the creditor, they're trying to collect against the shares. Well, we don't want someone who sued our shareholder to end up taking the shares of this person and becoming our co-partner.
Right.
So there are provisions that you can include in your shareholders agreement that would avoid that process as well. So there's many different layers to this, Lockwood.
It's obvious. And what I guess really the issue here is, you avoid a great deal of conflict and problems if you just do some advanced planning. And again, the simple solution to that, give our program a call. That is Harvell and Collins. Let's Talk Legal with us this afternoon. And that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And that number, 252 area code 726-9050. As I mentioned, go online to harvellandcollins.com. Cecil, Wes, as always, you're taking us through the process of wise planning and wise decision making. I do appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Lockwood.
Thank you. All right, Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins.